What that means is if you have a time translation killing field T, which generates this your time translation symmetry, now far away from that black hole, it is time-like. But if you have a rotating black hole, like a Kerr black hole, as you follow that killing field inward, at some point it becomes space-like around the black hole. And that region is called the Ergo region. So Penrose devised this process where you start off with a particle which has positive energy outside the black hole, outside the Ergo region. Now the energy here is defined as minus T dotted into the four momentum of the particle P. So that's positive. And then you allow that to fall into the Ergo region, and at that point it splits into two particles. Now inside the Ergo region, since T is space-like, it's possible then to choose a four momentum that is time-like for one of the two particles, such that minus TA PA is negative. So that means it has negative energy with respect to an observer at infinity, and you allow that particle to fall into the black hole. Now the other particle, by conservation of energy, then has to have more energy than the initial one. So when that particle exits the Ergo region and goes back off far away, you've extracted mass from the black hole. So this is the Penrose process, and there's nothing wrong with extracting mass from the black hole, because the only thing you have to be concerned about is the area law, which says that the area increases over time. And the area of a Kerr black hole involves also the spin in the expression here, this A squared. So as long as you also extract angular momentum, you can extract mass and still have the area increase. Now a similar process amplifies waves just like it does, just like before, but now we're dealing with waves, and this is called superradiance. And this can be understood directly from the area theorem. So if you have a wave with in a mode with azimuthal number m and frequency omega, and it impinges upon the black hole, you can use the first law of black hole mechanics to calculate the change in area. So the change in area is equal to the change in mass minus the angular velocity of the black hole times the change in angular momentum. And delta J over delta M for this wave is little m over omega. So if omega is less than m times big omega, then this quantity is negative. So in order to have positive change in area, it has to extract mass from the black hole. So delta M is negative. Yeah.
Could this be any kind of
wave? Yeah, I'm going to talk about what kind of waves it's going to be. Not any kind. So it's usually bosonic fields that you can have that. So if a fermion, you won't be able to do this process.
So this is a particle
outside. This is like some wave, like a scalar field comes in and interacts with the black hole, and it exits with this amplifier. No, it's coming from outside. It's coming in, and it's amplifying. And it can't be absorbed because that would violate the area theorem. It breaks down at some point. I don't remember exactly where. Yeah, I don't remember exactly. But yeah. Yeah, I don't remember exactly why it breaks down. I mean, yeah, I'm not. I'm only going to deal with bosonic fields, so no worries about that. Now, this gets more interesting if you surround the whole thing with some sort of reflecting boundary. So if we combine that Ergo region with a reflecting boundary, we have an instability. So what happens is we have our wave goes into the black hole, gets amplified, but then it hits this reflecting boundary, and then it goes back into the black hole and gets amplified again. And this just keeps happening. It gets multiplied by a constant factor each time, so you end up with an exponential growth. And this is what's known as the superradiant instability. So what is this reflecting boundary? Well, there's various things you could use. You could add a mass term to the field, and then you'd have like an effective potential that confines it. Or you could put in just some sort of mirror, and this is what was used in this paper by Press and Tucholsky, and they called this the black hole bomb. Or you could put it in anti-de Sitter space, which has a natural reflecting boundary condition at infinity. And that's what I'm going to focus on for this talk, because it's a very clean system to study. One thing to note is the black hole has to be sufficiently small and rapidly rotating compared to the size of this box in order to still have an ergo region. Because you can imagine that that Killing vector tries to start turning space-like, and then it runs into the black hole before that happens. And then you don't have your amplification mechanism anymore. So that this exponential growth is, you know, that's what happens to a linearized field. But there is going to be back reaction on the black hole when you pull out this mass and angular momentum. And there's a question of what is the end state, which is something I'm going to try to get at in my talk a bit. So why study this instability? There's motivations from astrophysics. So if you have a field with a mass term, you have that instability, like I said, and that would cause the black hole to spin down and perhaps emit gravitational wave signals, and you could use that to try to bound, say, the axion mass for dark matter, and this is stuff that Masha and Mina have worked on. There's a motivation from general relativity, which is just the theoretical importance of understanding black hole instabilities and where that might lead, and whether or not you, or what happens if you violate cosmic censorship. I'll talk a bit more about that. And then possibly from ADS-CFT, there could be some motivation if this manifests also on the CFT side. It might correspond to some thermalizing process. So the outline of my talk is as follows. I'm going to be talking about, it's really divided into two parts, concerned with two different papers that I posted recently. So, but they're related. So the first one has to do with the linear superradiant instability of ADS black holes with ergo regions to gravitational perturbations. So I'm going to be using this canonical energy method of Hollands and Wald to prove that any such black hole is unstable to superradiance. So just I'm just going to outline the proof, and we'll give all of the details. And then, but that's at the linear level. And at the nonlinear level, you'd really like to understand what is the end state. And we're going to address a very specific case where we'll look at a charged ADS black hole, and where here charge takes the role of angular momentum, and that's going to allow us to do spherically symmetric numerical relativity simulations to obtain the full evolution. So this will take into account, you know, the back reaction on the black hole, the evolution of all of the unstable modes, and then we'll get to the final state. So part one, the linear superradiant instability, and this is work with Stefan Hollands, Akihiro Ishibashi, and Bob Wald. So we imagine we have a background metric, which I'll denote GAB, and that background metric is an asymptotically ADS black hole solution to the Einstein equation in D greater than or equal to 4. And it has a, the only requirement it has is that it must have a horizon killing vector field, which I'll denote K. So notice here I'm talking about a horizon killing field instead of the time-like field, and what's more important difference in ADS versus asymptotically flat is that's the killing field we're going to deal with. So you have this horizon killing field that generates the horizon, and that field, if you follow it outwards, at some point in the neighborhood of infinity, it might become space-like, and that's where you have your ergo region. So that's just a difference in the two approaches and will be important. So that's the background metric, and we're going to imagine we have a metric perturbation gamma, which is a solution to the linearized Einstein equation with a reflecting ADS boundary condition. And our main result is that the black hole is unstable if K, the killing vector field, becomes space-like somewhere outside the black hole. In other words, if there's an ergo region. So the standard method that people use to prove instability is to search for mode solutions that grow in time. But this is hard to do, in particular if you have a complicated background solution in higher dimensions, or you look at gravitational perturbations, because this requires decomposing your field into modes and decoupling your equations, and that might not even be possible if you don't have enough symmetry. It's been done for cases like Kerr ADS, where you have just a single rotational axis, but it's not clear what would happen for more complicated situations. And you might even have a black hole with a single killing field, which has recently been studied, and you wouldn't be able to get anywhere. So we're going to use something called this canonical energy method, which only requires construction of initial data solving the constraint equations. We don't have to solve in time, which makes it a lot easier. Keep in mind, in gravity, of course, you do have constraint equations that you have to solve for your initial data. So the basic argument is outlined in this slide of the canonical energy method. So we define this canonical energy, E, which is an integral over some Cauchy hypersurface, like this one here, which is quadratic in the perturbation gamma. And this, I'm going to show how to derive the canonical energy in the next few slides, but it has important properties. In particular, it's gauge invariant. It's degenerate precisely on perturbations to other stationary black holes. So it's equal to zero if and only if it's a perturbation to another stationary black hole. It's conserved in the sense that the canonical energy evaluated on sigma 1 here is equal to the canonical energy evaluated on this part of infinity, sigma 2, and this part of the horizon. And it has positive flux properties at the horizon and infinity. So you have positive flux through here. In fact, you have zero flux through here because of the reflecting boundary condition. So then if we can find initial data for gamma on this initial time slice, and the canonical energy is negative, that means, well, all of this means that since the flux is positive, the canonical energy evaluated on sigma 2 has to be less than the canonical energy on sigma 1. And if it started off negative, it can only become more negative, but it can't approach a stationary solution since the canonical energy is zero on stationary solutions and we're already below zero and decreasing. So that just means that it cannot settle down to a stationary perturbation, and then the instability follows in that sense. So that's the basic method. Now I'm going to... It has to decrease because the flux of canonical energy through the horizon has to be positive. Yeah, so that essentially corresponds to the area increased theorem. So yeah, so that's a key point, is that the flux has to be positive. If we were doing this in asymptotically flat, by the way, there would be flux at infinity, and in fact, the only way you can get positive flux at infinity and through the horizon in asymptotically flat is to restrict to axisymmetric perturbations, which means you're not going to be able to apply this method to study perturbations carrying angular momentum, or you won't be able to study the superradiant instability. It's irrelevant to that. So this is a key feature of asymptotically ADS space times, is that you have no flux at infinity there. Okay, so now I'm just going to quickly sketch how we derive the canonical energy. So we start with the Einstein-Hilbert action, and from that you can derive a symplectic current, this WA, and that depends on two different perturbations, gamma 1 and gamma 2, and it basically goes as gamma 2 times the derivative of gamma 1 minus gamma 1 times the derivative of gamma 2. We then integrate WA over a hypersurface, we dot it into the normal vector and we integrate it, and then that gives us what we call the symplectic form. So sigma here is a space-like hypersurface. So this is kind of like the gravitational analog of the Klein-Gordon inner product, except, of course, we have metrics, right? An important fact is that for solutions to the linearized Einstein equation, if gamma 1 and gamma 2 are solutions, then W is divergence-free, so it's basically conserved in this sense. Okay, so I'm going to integrate that equation I just had, 0 is equal to the divergence, over a volume V, this volume here. And then I can use Stokes' theorem to rewrite it as an integral over the boundary of V. And now I'm going to take gamma 2 to be the derivative of gamma 1 along the k direction. So this is the Lie derivative along the k direction. So I'm looking at W of gamma and Lie k of gamma. And I'm going to consider the contributions from each boundary. So it can be shown that the contribution from this boundary vanishes, and then that's when we impose a reflecting boundary condition on gamma. And the contribution from this boundary consists of a non-negative part, which is quadratic in the perturbed shear of the horizon. And the fact that this is non-negative corresponds to area increase of the horizon. And we also get two contributions from the endpoint here, this B of B2 and B of B1. So you get, and these are D minus two spheres you're integrating over. And we've also imposed certain gauge conditions at the boundary, but don't worry about that. So now we're going to define the canonical energy to be the symplectic form of gamma and Li K gamma minus one of these boundary contributions. And then this inequality, this fact that this is positive here, this contribution turns, it leads to this inequality where the canonical energy evaluated on sigma 2 has to be less than or equal to the canonical energy on sigma 1. So it decreases in time. I'm not going to get into the details of the rest here, but once we restrict to certain gauge conditions on the horizon and infinity, together with the first order change in the area and the ADM quantities has to vanish, it can be shown that E is gauge invariant and degenerate precisely on perturbations to other stationary black holes. So those are all the criteria that we wanted in that first slide. So we have our stability criterion. Either it's non-negative for all such perturbations, in which case it's stable, or it's negative for some perturbation, in which case it's unstable. Right? So if it's always positive, you decrease towards zero, and that is just a stationary solution. I didn't mention that before. Yeah. I didn't say what this meant. So this is, this could, you know, if X is an asymptotic symmetry such as time translation, then this would be M, HX would be the ADM mass. So I'm saying, this is saying that the first order change in the ADM mass is zero. That's just a requirement on the perturbation. Now that's easy to do for our case because we're going to look at compact support perturbations which do not change any of these ADM quantities or the ADM mass, so it'll be trivial.
Well,
To higher order it will. Yeah, we're just concerned with first order at this point. Okay, so now that we have that method, all we have to do is construct initial data that has negative canonical energy, and that will prove instability. So let's go back to what I was saying at the beginning when I was talking about particles. So if you have a particle with four momentum p, then we define the energy of that particle to be minus k dotted into p, right? Where k is playing the role of t previously, right? So if there's an ergo region where k is space-like, then a time-like or null p can be chosen to make the energy negative in the ergo region. So similarly for a wave, we ought to be able to find a gravitational perturbation such that the canonical energy is negative. This is going to be kind of a particle-like state is what we're going to have in mind, like a wave packet that would be analogous to that particle up there. So this proceeds in two steps. The first step is we use a WKB method to obtain an approximate solution to the constraint equations. This approximate solution will be high frequency, and it will be of compact support, and it will have a canonical energy that will be of this form here, like omega squared times k dot p, where p is the gradient of the phase. So it's the direction this wave is moving. So we get this approximate solution with which we can make to have negative canonical energy by choosing k dot p negative. Now we can then obtain, we can fix this up, and we can use something called the Corvino-Shane method that allows you to obtain an exact solution to the linearized constraint equations that still has compact support and still has negative canonical energy. So it's this two-step process.
What if the frequency energy is large?
Sorry?
Compared to what? Omega is bigger than 1.
Oh, It would have to be, sorry?
What is that in units of?
Yeah, it would have to be in, I guess, I probably should have written omega goes to infinity or something like that. But yeah, it's just high frequency compared to any scale in the problem, or any curvature scale. Okay. So this last step is now I'm going to construct my initial data. So it's convenient, first off, to trade space-time quantities g and gamma for initial data quantities. So we have our initial data quantity q, which is a 3 metric, and its momentum PAB. And these are defined on this slice sigma here, where NA is the normal vector to that slice. So that corresponds to initial data for G, and then I have initial data for gamma, which is going to be my perturbed 3 metric and my perturbed momentum, which they're just interchangeable. So now we assume there's a region where K is space-like. So assume there's an ergo region, and we'll construct approximate initial data of compact support inside this region. So there's a trick, though. So here I'm imagining I have my slice sigma, and we're in part of it, we have an ergo region. So here, K is space-like. So since this is a space-like slice, we can choose it to be tangent to K, since both are space-like. So then this leads to this is in fact a simplified expression for the canonical energy, because there were a lot of other terms that went to zero, and I didn't write them out. But you can see this expression is K, the Killing vector, dotted into something quadratic in delta P and delta Q. It looks like some sort of energy. So of course we can't choose any values of delta P and delta Q. They have to satisfy these linearized constraint equations. So we have the linearized Hamiltonian constraint and the linearized momentum constraint. Those both have to vanish. Well, that seems daunting, but the way to deal with it is to WKB expand your initial data. So we'll write delta Q is equal to a sum over some WKB index n of some tensor capital QAB n times the power of omega times e to the I omega chi, where chi is another function, it's a phase function. And the idea is we take omega very large, and that gives us our WKB limit. But when we substitute this expansion into the constraint equations, they greatly simplify. And at each order, they take this form where you have some stuff involving, it's linear and algebraic in capital Q and capital P at the nth order, is equal to stuff that's that depends on the lower order WKB approximations. Now at zeroth order, this vanishes, and we just need a solution to this left-hand side is equal to zero. And it's very easy to choose one. So if we could choose basically any tensors P and Q such that P is equal to minus Q, a P0 is equal to minus Q, Q is zero is traceless, and QAB dotted into the gradient of chi vanishes. So that's motivated by, there were other choices too, but this is motivated by looking at a four-dimensional picture also. But anyways, the point is it's easy to solve, and we could go to any order we want because the left-hand side is always algebraic in Q and P, and we can just easily find a solution to any order. It doesn't matter because we're not going to finish with that. So that's where the Corvino-Shane method comes in, is we only are going to have to, it won't converge in general, and we only have to have a solution to a certain order, and then we correct that solution with this Corvino-Shane method to obtain an exact solution to the constraints. Okay. Yeah. All right. And then we plug that expansion and that solution into the canonical energy expression, and we get a very neat expression in the end, which is the canonical energy to leading order is minus omega squared times an integral of, it involves q squared, which is positive, and then k dotted into the gradient of chi. So if we choose chi such that k dotted into its gradient is positive, that then gives negative canonical energy for large omega. But now, as you pointed out, that's not a solution to the constraint equations. And I'm not going to get into this Corvino-Shane method because it's very kind of technical and mathematical, but it's this way of correcting the WKB initial data such that the linearized constraints hold exactly, the data remains smooth and compactly supported in a slightly larger region than the original one, and the correction to the canonical energy is sufficiently small as omega goes to infinity such that this term continues to dominate and you get a negative canonical energy.
Sure,
you can make it arbitrarily negative. The overall value, I wouldn't say matters that much because you're looking at linearized fields and everything will rescale by an overall amplitude.
Okay, so you're saying that this doesn't lead to predictions of megametric solutions because of the order of moment ambiguity?
Yeah, I guess that would, I mean, it's just because we're looking at linearized solutions. So like the overall amplitude of that solution is something that's not relevant to The overall amplitude will affect the next order corrections if you wanted to.
Yeah, but you might have thought, well, if it's small, then this should be reasonable approximation.
Yeah. You can make this term dominate over all the other terms. It's the only thing you need to take away from this. I mean, I could rescale. I don't have to make this go to minus infinity. I could make it go to, I could rescale everything by omega. And yeah. Oh, I mean, I'm only looking at I'm only looking at linearized fields at this point, and that's it. I mean, the overall scale won't matter, but it will matter in the later part of the talk where I'm looking at nonlinear perturbations. Okay. All right. So I'm just gonna conclude discussion of part one of this talk with the statement, which what we proved is any black hole in ADS with a horizon killing field that becomes space-like is linearly unstable to super radiant gravitational perturbations. And I think that's a nice result that generalizes, say, the Hawking-Real bound, where they said that, you know, if you have a Kerr ADS black hole and it's spinning rapidly enough, you have an instability, but if it's not spinning rapidly enough, you don't have an instability. And this is just a more general statement than that. It has to be rapid compared to the ADS scale. So
the curve I mentioned the spin from
well, yeah, that's basically it has to, well, you have your ink, I mean, the condition in fact involves the omega h, the angular velocity, and that has to be, it has to be big compared to the ADS scale. So depends how you choose your ADS scale. Okay, so that's the statement we've proven, and I mean, I didn't prove it, I gave a sketch of the proof, but it's in the paper. And I should point out that results that are similar would follow for any Lagrangian field theory with bosonic fields. And the whole analysis followed from having a Lagrangian, and you could just carry this through for any other field theory like that. So that's valid for early times, but as the perturbation grows, nonlinear effects do become important, and you have to take into account the back reaction of the perturbation on the black hole, which will change the black hole background as it loses spin and mass. And also that changing background is going to alter the dynamics of the perturbation. It might make some mode cease to become unstable, and you don't know what's going to happen. So what is the endpoint of the instability? And there's been a lot of speculation in the Kerr case that it might put a lot of energy into high frequency modes, which might form tiny black holes all over the place, or it might cause some naked singularity, but it's not clear what's going to happen. And we'd like to do some numerical simulations, but those are quite challenging in the general case because you're in 3+1 dimensions, and you have some very small scales that the energy might transfer to, and you have tricky boundary conditions at infinity, so it's a tough thing to do. So what we did, and this is work with Pablo Bosch and Louis Lehner, is study it in this simplified case of Reissner-Nordström ADS. So any questions, by the way, on the first part of the talk? Because this is going to be completely different now. Yeah.
So I don't know if this probably is impossible to do, but if you have this solution of one black hole in ADS,
yeah,
and say you add another black hole nearby or something like that, and can you ask the same questions that you did and see if there's still these solutions? Just to estimate what kind of, not the perturbation from the super radiant field itself, but from some external things would do.
So what exactly? So he rephrased that. I mean, so you imagine two black holes.
So the question is, so you've shown that the black hole is susceptible to this mm-hmm. instability, but this is for a single black hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the question is if you add some perturbation to the potential that's external to the black hole.
Yeah.
Can you derive some condition on when
Yeah, I mean, the only criterion we have right now is this ergo region thing. So are you thinking if you had like a massive field or something, you would get a different type of potential? Or?
Well, if the way that we, from the physics yeah. side, we do the calculation, you compute what the weight is for the
yeah.
of these particles. But if you add a perturbation, like if you have, like in a physical system, you have a star orbit.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, you might think that would, if it's sufficiently small, you might be able to say that's like a higher order
right.
effect.
Yeah.
But I mean, that would break the symmetry, and then the whole thing wouldn't
right.
go through.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm not quite sure how to deal with that, to be honest. I mean, other than trying to say it's small, and then
right.
also a perturbation, but. Yeah, so I can talk a bit more. Yeah, but the point is, though, well, that'll become a bit more clear when I'm done the talk, but the point is that you're going to have some radiation that can't fall into that black hole. And yeah, there'll be some stuff bouncing around outside, and people have tried to come up with end states, like George Santos has worked a lot on this, of these what he calls black resonator solutions, which are black holes with just a single helical killing field that corresponds to a black hole with radiation around it. But those all have ergo regions, so those are all unstable by our theorem here. So that can't be the end state since it's still unstable. Right. Yeah, that's one of the features. There's no other symmetries, yeah, aside from the asymptotic symmetries. But yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yeah.
I have a simple-minded naive question.
Yeah.
So when are those kind of solution of G meaning U plus 8 pi G U Maxwell's equation?
Yes. Yes. Oh, well, I'm going to explain that. That's the next part of the talk. So it's analogous to angular momentum. It's not transferring into angular momentum or anything. But I'll explain. So yeah, you have a Reissner-Nordström ADS black hole is just a charged black hole and in ADS. And it just here charge is playing the role of angular momentum. So we have to add in a complex scalar field, which is going to carry charge and can extract that charge from the black hole. So rather than having a gravitational field extract angular momentum, you have a charged field extracting charge. So it's just an analogous system. Is that clear?
Is there an ergo region?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Is there's no actual ergo region, but you might be able to define something called a generalized ergo region. And you have to, I mean, we're not going to deal with that, but that's the way you would try to define that. The methods that we discussed in the previous part don't actually apply to the RNADS case because this WKB limit it just doesn't apply. This WKB limit won't work because in the WKB limit, the charge of the scalar field has to go to zero. I mean, the ratio of the charge to mass has to go to zero just because of the expression for the charge goes as phi times the derivative of phi, while the expression for the mass has two derivatives in it. So if you take a very high frequency limit, this term is going to go to zero faster than this term. So while previously we could take the angular momentum, we could keep this ratio fixed, and it just won't work in this case. So it doesn't have an ergo region. So anyway, but you can still extract energy and charge if you have a charge scalar field. So the super radiance condition now takes the form of omega of the charged field times the black hole radius is less than the gauge coupling Q times the black hole charge, big Q. So this is analogous to this condition in the rotating case. But the nice feature now is that the instability occurs even in spherical symmetry, which makes numerical simulations feasible. Yeah.
So you're saying the condition that you had before, that there must be an ergo region to have instability?
Yeah.
You don't have that.
No, you do have a condition, which I'm going to get to, but it's a different type. You could define an effective ergo region for particles, and that the condition for the appearance of that ergo region is not the same as the condition for the appearance of this instability. Just because you're not trying to construct a wave packet, you can't construct a wave packet that holds the charge to mass ratio fixed for this field. So the method doesn't apply anymore. But you can make similar arguments involving effective ergo regions if you wanted to, but it wouldn't be as precise. Okay. But yeah, my point though is that you can do the simulations now because it's in spherical symmetry. So here's our model that we're going to consider. And we have a metric G, a Maxwell field A, and a complex scalar. And we consider the following Lagrangian. We have the Einstein-Hilbert action plus a negative cosmological constant term for ADS minus a quarter F squared for Maxwell field. And then we have the massless scalar field here, the dA psi squared. And dA here is the gauge covariant derivative that couples to the metric through this covariant derivative here and the gauge field. So everything's coupled. You could take variations of this Lagrangian and work out all of your equations of motion, your Einstein equation, your Maxwell equation, and your scalar field equations. And then that's what we did, and we're going to solve them numerically. And you can check that Reisner-Nordström ADS is a solution to this equation, but you have the scalar field vanishing in that case. So this is our numerical method, or next few slides, I guess. So we're going to work in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, ingoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates and spherical symmetry. So that allows us to write our metric and gauge fields in these forms. So the metric is minus A, just some function A, which is a function of our time variable V and radius, times dV squared plus 2 dV dr, plus another function sigma squared times the spherical volume element. And then the Maxwell field is just got one component, what I'm calling big W times dV. So this type of coordinate slices up our space-time like this. So we have our null slices, these V equals constant slices, indicated in green, and we have R equals constant slices like this. So what we're going to be doing is specifying initial data on one of these slices and just stepping forward in time and filling in the space-time on the computer. So these are equations of motion, which couple everything together. There's four components of the Einstein equation, two components of the Maxwell equation, and then you have your scalar field equation. We're going to actually solve five of these seven equations, and then we use the other ones to check on the validity of our numerical scheme, because they're not all independent. But I just want to make note of one of the notations. I'm writing d plus of a field. That's the time derivative along the outgoing null geodesic. So it's df, it's the time derivative dv of f plus a half times a times dr of f. So this is just I'm mentioning this because we're going to treat d plus of any field as an independent field in the numerics. And then a lot of these equations, if you look at them, are then just ordinary differential equations in the radial direction when you treat this as an independent field. So if you look at, say, this first equation, you have d plus of sigma prime, that's a radial derivative, and you have other radial derivatives in your equation. That just, don't worry too much about that, but that's needed for the method. So you can plug in your metric and Maxwell expansions into those equations and obtain a power series solution at infinity. So this is what we get. Now if we look at this, we've got two parameters, m and q, that appear in these expansions. These are the ADM mass and the ADM charge of the solution, and we have to specify these as boundary conditions. We also have another free function that appears in the expansion of the scalar field. This is a function of time, and it's an unknown function, and it's determined from a solution. So we've put in a few assumptions into this expansion. In particular, we have this reflecting boundary condition imposed, which eliminated some higher order terms in our scalar field, and we've also fixed some residual gauge freedom. But this is the expansion we're going to get. So you can think of this as what we're doing for the psi field. If you just think of an ordinary box that you're evolving in, we're imposing a Dirichlet condition that the field has to vanish at the boundary. This is just makes it reflective. And then this phi 3 is the radial derivative. It's like the Neumann condition, which we can't set independently. It just comes out of the equations. Okay, so then this is the expansion, and we need this to solve it, and we're going to impose m and q as boundary conditions.
You might be expecting all sorts of independence at high orders, but you think this just falls out?
Yeah. This is it, asymptotically. I mean, at higher order, yeah, that's it. I mean, the phi 3, I mean, at higher orders, this phi 3 is going to carry through into other terms, but that's it. Yeah.
Or not.
We will have a horizon depending on the size of that, yeah.
We don't have a horizon.
Yeah. No, I think we'll always have a horizon. I mean,
we're not going to do anything if it's a major.
Yeah. If you chose Q too large, you might not have a horizon. Sure. That's right. But if we were to solve the equations and we set psi is equal to zero initially, we'll just get Reissner-Nordström ADS if we follow this. It's a check we did on the code. So here's the integration procedure. We start off with initial data for psi specified on some slice here. And then we have all of those equations, which I pointed out are radial ordinary differential equations. So that means we can integrate them along this line. And we get then d plus sigma a, sigma w, and d plus psi all on this time slice. And I've drawn these slices going a bit past the horizon because we integrate a little bit into the horizon, but we stop before we get to the singularity. So we get all those quantities, and we've imposed the boundary conditions, of course, to do that integration. And then we use this definition of d plus psi to kind of invert it, and then we get the time derivative of psi along this time slice. And then that allows us to integrate one step in time, and then we have psi on the next time slice. And we're going to just look at the apparent horizon, which is the outermost trapped surface. So we can identify that in the code by looking at the various quantities in the metric. Yes, we do. I'm not mentioning that, but we do. We don't integrate from r equals infinity because our computer doesn't have enough RAM. But so we actually integrate. We define a coordinate 1 over r, and that's what we use in our code. Anyway, so then we repeat this whole procedure, and then you just keep going. It works, as I can show you in our simulations. So before I show you the simulation, I'm going to point out we're going to consider small black holes, so the radius of the black hole is small compared to the ADS scale, so that's going to guarantee we have an effective ergo region. And we'll look at compactly supported initial data for psi, which is of small amplitude, so the initial state is basically the black hole with some tiny little perturbation. And so for here, I mean, I've chosen that Q is 80% of maximum, little q is 12, and so on. So what we're going to see is we start with a perturbation here. It's going to propagate out to infinity, and then it's going to just jump back because of the way our coordinates are, and then it will propagate again out to infinity, and so on. It'll look like the wave is just always moving that way, basically, but that's just an effect of the coordinates. So if I evolve it, I'm looking here at the real part of the scalar field. You can see there's this perturbation out near infinity, and it's always moving that way, this wave, and it's slowly growing in amplitude. We'll just watch it for a while. It's kind of like it's not just one mode. If you look at it, it's kind of messy looking. And don't worry, it only has to get up to about 1500. But one other thing we can look at here is we're integrating to a little bit past the horizon, and you can see the code is stopping the integration at this point, which is moving outwards. This is the horizon of the black hole moving outwards. Yeah, so you don't see that. Yeah, well, the thing is you don't really see that because of the way the coordinates are. Once you get out here, I mean, we're looking at subsequent, you know, slices, these null slices, right? And then you get to here, and then you're on the next slice, and it's moving outward again. So it's just an effect of the coordinates. You don't really see them going in. But anyway, now we've settled down, and we just have one really big mode outside, and it's just oscillating harmonically. And this is the final state, and it's just going to stay like this forever. If you looked at the metric quantities, those are all constant because you can have a harmonically oscillating field and the stress energy tensor is still time independent. So yeah, this is the final state. What is the frequency? It's related to the lowest mode. I'll get to that. It's related to the lowest mode of oscillation of the scalar field. But so the final state is just this kind of, call it a hairy black hole, which is this black hole with the scalar field sitting far away, just oscillating like that. And we'll look at the modes more.
And when is the ergo
region? Well, there's no actual ergo region, but the effective ergo region would be somewhere around infinity.
It is outside the arc, yes?
Yeah. It would have to be outside, yeah.
I'm running this my first line of design. I did something stupid.
Yeah.
I got something which is, I have perturbations plus a growing horizon. Surely that's saying I have more energy than I had when I started.
No, you're still extracting energy out. So the point is you can grow your horizon and extract energy from the black hole. So that's the whole point of super radiance.
You're reducing the charge. Yeah, you're saying it's
And it, yeah, it's from the charge. I mean, it's explicitly enforced that we conserve energy because we're setting the ADM mass as a boundary condition and the ADM charge.
How do you extract the charge? Because the charge of the particle is conserved, not
the total charge is conserved. The charge of the black hole is decreasing, the charge of the scalar field is increasing. I'll have some plots in a few.
Oh.
You just get more particles. That Yeah. Okay. So now I'm plotting the actual area. The previous one was just depending on, it could have been a coordinate effect, but this is the area as a function of time. It starts off at 1, I've normalized it, and then it increased by 85% for that simulation, then it just stays constant afterwards. The time scale of the growth is going to be the linear mode growth time scale. I'm not, I don't know that off the top of my head. I'll talk about the modes and then maybe that will make it clearer. I'm plotting the charge here, which is conserved. So this blue curves the charge of the black hole evaluated as just at the horizon. And this orange curve is the charge of the scalar field, just an integral of that charge. And we see that the black hole loses its charge. I mean, it's negative, but it loses its charge while the scalar field picks up this charge. And the sum of the two is constant, as it should be. Notice, though, that there's a bunch of fluctuations. It's not a very smooth process. And that goes along with the fact it was kind of a messy-looking simulation. And I'll come back to why exactly you get those. You can also look at the boundary field. Remember the phi 3 quantity, which is a function of time. And we see it's got all these oscillations. It grows up quite big, and then it kind of settles down into this final state, which just oscillates. We can zoom in on that early period, and it looks like this. And again, it looks like maybe it's a sum of a few modes or something. Well, let's think about those modes. So people have studied the linearized modes in this system, and I'm not going to go into that in detail, but we can get a good approximation if we think about the black hole as being small compared to the ADS scale. So then the scalar field modes we're going to approximate by the empty ADS modes, which we know very well have frequency 2n plus 3 over L, where L is the ADS scale and n is any integer. So let's combine that with the instability criterion. We get that mode n is unstable if 2n plus 3 is less than qql over rh. So there can be many unstable modes, just bounded by this inequality, and the n equals 0 mode is the most unstable of all of the modes. So here, we see all the modes. So this is a spectrogram that we produced from the phi 3 field. And what that means is I take the whole time interval and I split it up into short time intervals. And on each of those short time intervals, I perform a Fourier transform. So we see the mode content as a function of time. So here's the time axis. Here's the frequency. And look what we get. We get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 modes that are all growing exponentially. And this is a log scale. So they're all growing exponentially. But one by one, starting with the highest frequency, they stop growing and they fall back into the black hole. That's because the black hole is losing mass and charge, so the inequality is no longer holds for that mode. I mean, it becomes too big. So it gets reabsorbed, and they all get reabsorbed except for the lowest frequency mode, and that one just stays there as this scalar condensate that we saw. So that's the final state. You have a black hole plus that lowest mode with zero growth rate. Yeah.
Does this depend on, initially you send in some scalar?
Yeah.
Does this depend on what the...
It depends a little bit on that, it's just the fact that when we put in like a sine wave times some compact support function, and that contains a whole lot of frequencies, and there were some you don't see that got immediately fell into the black hole. So you get a slight difference in the intermediate times, but at late times you always end up with that lowest mode just oscillating outside. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think this plot kind of really shows everything that's happening. Asymptotically flat charged black holes with a massive field will have a similar property. Yeah, that's right. So In the last few minutes, I'm just going to explain what happens when we change Q, the gauge coupling. And well, when we increase Q, looking at that inequality, we have a whole bunch more unstable modes. So in fact, since you have more scalar modes, you get much more rapid extraction of energy from the black hole. And this is essentially plotting the area as a function of time. It's almost a step function once it gets going. We can also look at the charge as a function of time, and it's a similar effect, and we find that larger Q will extract more charge. Now, there's a story behind that, which is larger Q means the charge to mass ratio of the scalar field for a given profile is larger, which means that you can only extract all of the charge of the black hole, all big Q, and then that means you're extracting very little mass at the end also for the higher Q. It's a massless field. I haven't plotted the mass of the field. I can't. It's not really well defined in GR.
Okay.
Yeah.
Steven?
Yeah.
In your data, if you lose all the charges, is your black hole field small compared to
yeah, it is because I'll show you the final state actually right here. So what am I plotting? This is the Misner-Sharp mass as a function of Q, the final state. And I don't really have time to get into it, but what this means, you can take away from it, for larger Q, this is flat, which means there's not much charge interior of this radius. So you're approaching this solution where your charge is located further away from your black hole. And also your scalar field settles down further away from your black hole for larger Q. That's also the case. Yeah, essentially all of it. If we look at this plot. The charge stays in the black, basically the end state is the charge stays in the scalar field far away from the black hole. And it no charge in the black hole. And that's allowed. What? Yeah, that's the final state. Yeah, it's the repulsion is what pushes it out. Yeah, at the end. And so yeah, for larger Q, it is further away. And the end state, this is a plot where I'm comparing the irreducible mass, which is essentially the area, compared to the irreducible mass of a Schwarzschild ADS black hole with the same mass as the original black hole. So what we see is that as Q is increased, the final state has almost the same area as a Schwarzschild ADS black hole. So it's got no charge, it's got the same area as a Schwarzschild ADS black hole. All the charge is far away. Essentially, what we have is a Schwarzschild ADS black hole with some distant condensate. And that happens because for larger Q, the scalar field charge to mass ratio is increased. As the scalar field extracts the full ADM charge Q, it extracts very little mass then. So then the final state is a Schwarzschild ADS black hole surrounded by a distant low mass, high charge condensate. So a few words about the rotating case. So here's the instability criterion for RN ADS. Here it is for Kerr ADS. But the main difference between these is that this Q parameter here is a fixed parameter for RN ADS, but the M can take any integer. That's the azimuthal number of your field. So what this means is that your most unstable mode for Reissner and Nordström ADS has n equals 0, and L, the angular momentum, is also equal to 0. But the most unstable mode of Kerr ADS has n equals 0, and L equals m going to infinity. And that suggests you're going to put all this energy in these high-frequency modes if you settle down to your lowest frequency mode in the end, which kind of defines your final state. If you plug this mode back into your instability criterion, you get this instability criterion we had for Reissner Nordström ADS, and you get the Hawking-Real bound for the rotating case. So to conclude, At the linear level, all ADS black holes with ergo regions are unstable. In the Reissner-Nordström ADS case, we looked at the nonlinear evolution, and we saw that we extract charge and mass from the black hole from using these multiple modes of the scalar field. And as this unfolds, the higher frequency modes then cease to be superradiant, and they fall back into the black hole, and they're resulting in this complicated dynamics. And the final state is this hairy black hole with the scalar condensate distributed far away. Kerr ADS case, the same arguments are suggesting an M goes to infinity condensate in the final state, since this is the most superradiant mode. And it's not clear what that's going to amount to nonlinearly. And if we want to think about astrophysics, just to make some connection with what other people have done here, is that if you have instead of having that infinite barrier of this ADS box, you have a finite size barrier that arises from your mass term. So I think that's going to provide a cutoff in the mode energy that you can confine, and you probably don't have this M goes to infinity issue in that case. And that's it. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The electric charge of astrophysical bodies, including black holes, discharges all into the region.
Yeah.
So, if you can show that if there's any electric charge in the black hole, it has a negligible effect on the mixture. But this is a practical question.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're doing this for practical reasons. What's that?
It's a model.
Yeah.
But in practice, experimentally, there is no little charge.
Yeah, I know. We're just doing it.
Electrically neutral.
Yes, I agree. Real black holes don't have much electric charge, and we're just doing this because it's the only practical problem. Yeah.
Instead of doing Kerr all the time.
Yeah. It's doable. The simulations for Kerr would be impossible.
Right.
So the objective would be to move to Kerr.
Yeah.
And then maybe impossible with today's computers.
Yeah.
Presumably at some point that could be done, and you learn from the Reissner-Nordström case some of what Kerr might look like. All this still assumes a great degree of symmetry. And question, what might we learn from this, or what could be done to determine whether any of this carries over to a situation that doesn't have this
spherical
symmetry or axial symmetry?
Well, I think all of this, if you have the symmetry is inserted to make the problem kind of easier to simulate, but I think once you're looking in the nonlinear case, I mean, it's not really symmetric anymore, because you have, in the rotating case, it's not really symmetric anymore, and you're going to have asymmetries like that. I don't think the symmetry is a huge factor in anything.
So you think that the stability that you're looking at could be a generic result that will apply to non-symmetric situations with some other kinds of boundary conditions?
Yeah, sure. The black hole we're dealing with initially in the first part of the talk has very little symmetry, just the horizon Killing field, almost every black hole also is going to be stationary, and usually. So we're, yeah.
One more question. When it emits the black hole charge, black hole emits the charge increase, and we are no longer in the spherical radiance region.
Yeah.
So what about?
Well, the final state is it becomes less and less super radiant until it's just a borderline, and you have a mode that doesn't get absorbed or amplified, and that's the final state.
So it has charge.
The mode has charge. The black hole, the black hole will still have some charge provided Q isn't too big. If little Q is too big, then you extract everything. Yeah. Any other questions? All right, thanks.